Isaiah chapter 57 is where we're at tonight, and interesting chapter. Actually, we're starting in chapter 56 and verse 9, but let me give you just a little bit of an intro into it. Just to remind you, we're really looking hard at now at the Redeemer in the last half of the book of Isaiah, especially starting in chapter 40. We really start seeing the Redeemer, not the typical Redeemers like Cyrus, but the real Redeemer, of whom Cyrus was just a type. But then when we got to chapter 53, we saw the Redeemer in what capacity? Do you remember? What did we see in chapter 53 about the Redeemer? A suffering Redeemer, a severely suffering Redeemer. He was marred beyond recognition, bruised, beaten, battered, and finally killed in chapter 53. And when the Jews heard of this kind of a Redeemer, that is a bleeding, bruised, beaten Redeemer, they were forced to recognize that he was not coming to redeem them from Babylon. He was not coming to redeem them from worldly oppressors, but he was coming to redeem them from sin. Redemption from sin required suffering. That's what caused Jesus to come with the mission of suffering, you see. Come in, brother and sister. We are taking a look here. We're in Isaiah 57, brother. And the Redeemer was a suffering Redeemer. He came to redeem from sin, and so that's why he must needs suffer. And this is exactly the kind of Redeemer that we saw in chapter 53. When we come to chapter 54, it's natural that the redeemed are singing for joy in chapter 54 and verse 1. Obviously, they're singing for joy because the Redeemer is coming. That's a good reason to sing, don't you think? But more specifically, in this particular context, they are singing because their numbers are going to be increased. The numbers of the redeemed are going to be greatly increased. You might remember that the characteristic of the redeemed in the Old Testament was that they were always a tiny remnant of the nation. Just a little bitty scraggly remnant is all they were. That was the redeemed. Everyone else in the world lost, reprobate. And so that was the characteristic of the redeemed in the Old Testament. Their numbers never seemed to increase, whether we're talking about Elijah's day or any day really in Israel's history, all the way up to the coming of Christ. It was only the tiny group that were redeemed within the nation. And so Isaiah compares them in chapter 54 to a barren widowed woman. Do you remember? A barren widowed woman. Now, how much chance does a barren widowed woman have of bearing children? None, really. If she's barren, and just add to it, she doesn't have a husband. And therefore, that was the nature of the redeemed in the Old Testament. But the message of Isaiah was that this was going to change. This little band of the redeemed called the remnant was going to greatly increase. And so what does Isaiah tell this little band of the redeemed to make bigger? What are they to make bigger? Their tents. Isaiah was making this remarkable prophecy in 700 B.C., and he said, you need to make bigger tents because you're fixing to grow exponentially. This was really a very stunning prophecy. And part of the big news was not only that the Redeemer would be a suffering Redeemer, but that he would bring in who? Who would this Redeemer bring into the fold? Gentiles. Take a look at Isaiah 54:3. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit thee, who? Gentiles. We saw again last week in chapter 56 that the stranger, remember the stranger? We took a look at the stranger and the eunuch last week. Do you remember? And who is the stranger? Who did we determine that the stranger is? Who would be the stranger to Israel? The Gentiles, the Gentile man. And the point in the early part of chapter 56 is that the stranger, that is the Gentile, will be on equal footing with the Jew. Equal footing. The Gentile man will no longer be separate from the Jew. Was the Gentile separate from the Jew in the Old Testament? Of course. Even when the Gentile man proselyted into the Jewish nation, they kept them out in the outer courts, you see. They couldn't take advantage of the full benefits, but they stayed in the outer courts or the Gentile courts. And so they were certainly separate in the Old Testament. But when the Redeemer comes, he said, God says, don't even let the Gentile man say that he's separate, you see. And you and I, as Gentiles, we don't feel that we're separate, do we? We feel like we're every bit as much in the family as a Jewish Christian. And that's the point. So he says in 56:3, neither let the son of the stranger that hath joined himself to the Lord speak, saying, the Lord hath utterly separated me from his people. Don't say that, Mr. Gentile man. So here's kind of the main themes that we're going into now. Number one, the Redeemer's coming. We're all agreed the Redeemer is coming. He will be what kind of a Redeemer? Suffering Redeemer in chapter 53. Thirdly, the Redeemer is going to greatly increase the numbers of the redeemed. Big news, no longer going to be a little remnant. going to greatly expand. In chapter 55, we found that this is all going to be done by the bringing in of a new age. Take a look at chapter 55 and verse 3. Incline your ear and come unto me here, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you. So no longer going to be under that old covenant, but God is going to bring in a new covenant, which includes the Gentiles. And then fifthly, the Gentiles and the Jewish outcasts. That's the eunuch. He was a Jewish man, but he was ceremonially unclean, that couldn't come into the congregation. So the Gentiles and the outcasts are no longer going to be separate. They're going to be included in the Redeemer's kingdom. Amazing new revelation about God's kingdom. Now, tonight, when we come to the last part of chapter 56, it's sort of like the next scene of a play. Anybody in here ever been to a play? And you go and they open the curtains and it's scene number one, you see. And they go through that scene, then the curtains will close and open up a different setting and so forth. And they have several scenes. Well, the curtain has gone down on the last scene here, and then the curtain opens and we have another scene. In the previous scene, we saw the strangers and the eunuchs. And they're going to be brought into to be included in the kingdom. But in this scene, starting in verse 9 of chapter 56, we switch our attention back to the lost Jewish nation. Now, here's the way things kind of look. I've drawn this circle up here on several occasions, so you're well familiar with it. Let's say that this circle is the nation of Israel. Are all of them saved? Clearly not. Many, many wicked. In fact, the Bible teaches us over and over that really at any one given time, there's really only a remnant. A remnant of people are really God's elect. And so you have a little bit of the nation is the redeemed. They are the redeemed. But the others are not. You wouldn't say that they are the redeemed. They're part of the nation, but not the redeemed. And the idea is that this is just a little remnant here, but God is going to add to it by filling in another circle. You see, this circle represents the the truly redeemed. And we have some from Israel and some from where? Gentiles. That makes up the fullness of the redeemed. And so we're going to be talking about that. But when now the focus is going to shift back to this part of the circle. You see, this is lost Israel here. So the scene, the curtain goes up. We now have the scene, and we're going to take a look at this lost nation. What's going to happen to them now that the Redeemer is coming, you see? And the first entities or beings that we see in verse 9 are who? Beasts. We have some beasts. Let's just draw the picture. Let's call these, we'll say they're bees. Beasts. So we got beasts all around. And then the second group of people that we see are who? Watchmen. So you got watchmen here. So the idea is, we're going to see, that there is a fold of sheep here. And there are watchmen standing around this fold. You get the idea. So we'll put W's there. They're standing at each corner. And they are watching out, or supposed to be watching out for the sheep that are in the fold. So we got these wild beasts out there. We've got watchmen. That's what a watchman would do. We've got a flock of sheep. He stands there and he protects them from the beasts that would otherwise come and eat up the sheep. But let's just read about these watchmen. His watchmen are blind. You see that? His watchmen are blind. How would you like to have a watchman like that? Can't see. Blind as a bat. And he's going to be our watchman, you see. The watchman is blind and ignorant. They are all ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. Dumb meaning they don't speak, right? So if the watchman, even though he's blind, let's just say he could see something. Even if he could see something, he couldn't tell you about it. Because he's a dumb dog. Can't bark. And so they're dumb dogs. They cannot bark, you see. Not only that, they're sleepy dogs. You ever seen a dog? You want him to watch your backyard and you look out there and he lay down asleep with his feet up in the air, you see. And that's the way the watchmen were. Sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber, it says. How'd you like to have a watchdog like that? Not only that, in verse 11, look, he talks further about these watchmen. Yea, they are greedy dogs. Got some moral problems too, whoever these dogs represent, you see. Greedy dogs, which never have enough. They just can't get enough of stuff. Yes, sir. Yes. I'm going to talk about in a minute who these are. But right now we're just getting the scriptural reference to them. They're greedy dogs that can never have enough, and they are shepherds, you see. That's where I'm kind of getting the analogy of a sheepfold. Because these watchmen are also called shepherds. So they're called watchmen, they're called dogs, they're called shepherds in verse 11. But they're shepherds who cannot what? Understand. They're pretty ignorant. Ignorant, stupid shepherd. If you're a sheep, you don't want that kind of shepherd. They all look to their own way. Everyone for his own gain from his quarter. In other words, whatever his station is, he's looking for his own gain. If he's the head of the Department of Defense in Israel, you see, that's his quarter. And he's looking to make a profit. We have leaders like that sometime, even in our country, don't we? They want to make a profit, not too concerned about the security of the nation, but... All right. So that's the three groups that we have. The sheep are sort of implied here. They're the group that the shepherd is protecting. So you got these beasts, they're around, and the watchmen are watching out, and you've got the sheep there. Now, we're going to take a look, first of all, at the command to the beasts. What is the command that is given to the beasts in verse 9? Come to devour. So somebody gives a command to these beasts to come and devour the sheep. So that's the command, is to come. So these beasts around the sheep pen are salivating while they are surrounding the sheep. And all of a sudden someone says to the beast, come and eat. Now that is, they are to attack the sheep. So now we want to consider, who is the issuer of this command? Who do you think it is that commands these beasts to attack the sheep and devour them? Who do you think? Well, okay, that's one idea. I've got another idea. And it seems to be that it's God that is telling the beasts to attack. Now, the reason that causes us to go, wait a minute, is because we always think of sheep as being redeemed sheep, you see. But this is just an analogy here. He's not suggesting that the sheep are God's redeemed, right? The sheep are the people of Israel. The people of Israel have watchmen. That's the watchmen probably are the leaders, the elders, the false prophets, those wretched priests, everybody that's on the take, you see, and not watching out for the sheep. They're blind, they don't understand, and ignorant, dumb dogs. I'm sorry? Yes. Yes. God is speaking in this context. Take a look at Isaiah 56:1. 56:1 says, thus saith thee who? Lord, that's Jehovah, God. So God is speaking all the way down through verse 8, and it seems that he's still speaking in verse 9, you see. And so the issuer of the command seems to be God. By the way, isn't it interesting how powerful God is? I hope that we never stop learning how great and awesome he is. His sovereign control extends not only to rational creatures like human beings and angels, but it also extends to irrational creatures. Remember that from theology class? He causes animals to do his will. So is God capable of telling the beast, go devour the sheep? Certainly he is. He can tell animals to go do his will. I remember one occasion after the death and resurrection of Jesus. Jesus walked out on the shore, and the disciples had been out there fishing all night, and they had caught nothing, and Jesus called out to them from the shore, and he said, throw your nets on the other side of the boat. And when they did, they filled their nets. God causes the fish to swim wherever he so desires, you see. He calls the fishes to the right side of the boat, and he says, don't you dare go on the left side of the boat, you see. Now, in our analogy, the beasts of the field are not really beasts at all. They represent something, you see. This is an analogy, and in the analogy, the beasts represent something. What do you think that the beasts represent, perhaps? Pardon me? Yes, the enemy nations, and in this particular context, Babylon is the one that's front and center. So the beasts then would be the ravenous nations that would like to swallow Israel up, eat her up, and destroy her. And so that's perhaps who the beasts are here. They are vicious beasts looking to devour everything in their path. God used Assyria, of course, as an instrument. Remember, God brought down Assyria on Israel, and he then used the Babylonians as an instrument of judgment. Later, he used Persia and Greece and then Rome. You might remember back in Daniel, in chapter 7, Daniel prophesied about coming kingdoms. And these kingdoms in his dream were represented as what? Well, that's earlier in the book. That's Daniel 3, I believe. But Daniel 7, they were beasts. The first was like a lion with eagle's wings. The second was like a bear with three ribs in his mouth. You notice that the bear is devouring something. The third was like a leopard, and the fourth was a nondescript beast with iron teeth, and it had 10 horns. So these beasts obviously represent some entity that is capable of coming in and devouring Israel. And they're told to come. They're told to come and devour them. So let's take a look at the purpose of the command. Now, who made the command according to our analysis here? God made the command. And now let's take a look at the purpose of the command in verse 9. All ye beasts of the field, come to devour, yea, all ye beasts in the forest. His watchmen are blind. They are all ignorant, they are all dumb dogs, they cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber, yea, they are greedy dogs, which can never have enough, and they are shepherds that cannot understand, they all look to their own way, everyone for his gain from his quarter. Come ye, say they, I will fetch wine. Trying to look for the purpose of the command. I have it as verse 9, but... Oh, I'm sorry. I went way past what I was intending to. The purpose of the command is to devour in verse 9, right? Come to devour. My mind went haywire there for a minute. Come to devour. The purpose is obviously judgment, right? Why is God calling the beasts? Why is he telling them to come? It's judgment. Come to devour. God had told them long ago, if you obey me, I will bless you, and if you disobey me, I will what? Curse you. That's Deuteronomy 28. And now finally it was time for cursing. The Babylonians began the devastation and the Romans finished it off. Years later, the nation of Israel was devoured by the beasts of the field. The reason for the judgment is found in verses 10 and following. One of the reasons for the coming judgment was that the watchman had gone to sleep. Now, you never want... You see, the leaders of a nation are almost always a reflection of the nation. We either elect them or if however they come to power, we allow them to stay there. And so leaders are almost always a reflection of the people. And when the leaders are bad, usually the virus extends to the people. And so we find here that they are blind in verse 10. They're ignorant in verse 10. They cannot understand in verse 11. And so that's the condition of the watchman. It renders them ripe for judgment. They're dumb dogs in verse 10. We've already talked about that. They couldn't alert anyone to danger, even if they had to. Dumb dogs. They're also sleepy dogs in verse 10. And this described the leadership of Israel. Was the leadership of Israel sleepy spiritually? Yes. All they wanted to do was slumber spiritually. They had virtually gone to sleep. They weren't interested in the things of God enough to stay awake. In addition to that, there were greedy dogs in verse 11. They were out for their own gain. A nation is in trouble when her leaders are only out for personal gain. The leaders want to get rich. And usually they get rich at the nation's expense. The poor people, at their expense. Not really looking out for the welfare of the people, but looking out for their own welfare. How do I get elected next time? What do I need to be for today to get elected next time? And the leaders of Israel were greedy dogs. In addition to that, in verse 12, what else were they? In verse 12, the leaders. Well, they were wine bibbers. They say to each other, let's go get some wine. Isn't that what it says in verse 12? Come ye, they say, I will fetch wine and we will fill ourselves with strong drink. And so we see that they were wine bibbers. Notice that when they went to get wine, what kind of wine did they really prefer? Strong wine. Also in verse 12, we see another fallacy of this group. The watchmen told each other that all is well. Isn't that what leaders like to tell you? Oh, it's fine. All is well. And that's what they like to say. Even though the beasts were gathered around, the beasts were ready to strike, the watchmen were asleep, but all's okay. Don't worry about it. So look at verse 12. It says, come ye, I'll fetch wine and we'll fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow shall be as this day. It's going to be just like today, tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be just as good as today. That is for us. You see, we're getting rich off the people. Tomorrow is going to be a good day, and it's going to be even more abundant. Do you see that in verse 12? We're going to take some more money tomorrow. You know, God is a just God. You know, God only takes so much of that stuff, and then it's time for judgment, isn't it? And so we find that that is the reason for the judgment. Now we get into a difficult section, but I think I've sort of hammered it out a little bit for you. The next section I call the precursor to judgment. You see, this Redeemer's coming. The beasts have been commanded to come. Now that doesn't mean that it's going to happen in one day, but you see, there was a Babylonian invasion, and later the Persians oppressed them and the Greeks. Finally, the Romans, you see, it was extended over a good number of years. Nevertheless, judgment was coming, but what was going to happen before the judgment actually finished off the nation? I call that the precursor to judgment. Well, in verse 1 of chapter 57, who is going to perish? The righteous. The righteous are going to perish. Now, that stuns us when we read that. And that's because when we think of the word perish, we're thinking of dying eternally, going to hell. But that's not what it's talking about here, but it's talking about the righteous dying. There's a difference between dying and perishing. Spiritually and eternally. The idea here seems to be that because of the failure of the watchman and the general depravity of the leaders of Israel, severe judgment is coming, and there will be a general reduction in the numbers of the righteous in the Jewish society. While the leadership is caught up in self-indulgence and self-service, something is happening out there in society. And the first thing that's happening is the righteous are passing off the scene. The righteous are perishing. They're passing off the scene. They are decreasing in number. That sometimes it seems like that's happening in our country, our own country. We see it, don't we? A general depravity is sweeping over the nation. And it seems that the number of the redeemed are less and less. Perhaps 25% of the population were righteous, but many of them now have passed away. And there are only 10% of the nation left that are righteous. That's what Isaiah is pointing out here. The Jewish society was becoming more and more unrighteous. He puts it another way. In the same, I think it's the same verse. The merciful men are taken away. This is another way of saying that the number of godly men in Israel was on the decline. Now, let's note from that righteous men are merciful men. Have you ever thought about that? Righteous men are merciful men. They're equated in our text. It reminds me of the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, 7, where it says, "Blessed are the merciful," you see. That's the man that God has saved, the man that is merciful. The godly man is a good-hearted man. He's a compassionate man, and he's the kind of man who actually does something. Remember, we talked about that. A merciful man not only has compassion, but he stops and helps. One man may be compassionate, but he just walks by and he says, "I sure feel sorry for that man." But the merciful man stops and does something. And these kind of men were going to die out in Israel. They were becoming fewer and fewer in number, you see. The righteous are perishing. The merciful man is taken away. That leaves a nation in a difficult and desperate situation. Now, the thing about this we find in a verse, one or two, whichever one it is that no one was noticing that the righteous were passing off the scene. Let's read it. "The righteous perishes, and no man layeth it to heart." Do you see that? No, they don't even consider it. Society is just spiraling down. The redeemed are dying off. Most likely naturally, some by injury, whatever. They die out and they're not replenished. So the righteous are passing off the scene, and they are being taken away, and no one seems to notice. Did you notice that? How blind we are sometimes to the things that are happening in our own nation. You see, we just don't pay attention to it. And finally, one day we wake up and our whole system of values has gone away. So I want you to notice here that God had a purpose in this. Why did God let the righteous pass off the scene before judgment came in its fullness? You get the sense that it is a purposeful taking away, and that's what it says in verse 1. It says, "The righteous is taken away from what? The evil to come." The beasts are about to come, and devour the nation, but God graciously and mercifully, it seems to me, let the righteous sort of die out before enduring the brunt of the judgment. It appears that in the last few hundred years of the nation, before Christ came, that God purposely took the righteous away from the nation. They passed off the scene and were not replenished. And what was the reason for this in our text? It was so that they would not experience the judgment that was to come on the nation. See how good God is. Look how good God is. I want you to consider the days of Noah. It seems that God did the same thing then. He let the righteous die out so that they would not suffer the flood. Noah and his family, it seems, were the only righteous ones left on the earth, weren't they? You see, judgment is not for the righteous, but judgment is for who? The wicked. And God graciously let the righteous pass off the scene before the flood. And the eight righteous people who were left were saved on the ark. Think of Sodom and Gomorrah. I don't know how many righteous people were there, but God said, I'll spare it for if there are 50 righteous people. There weren't. I'll spare it for 30. All the way down, I'll spare it if you can find 10. Finally, there just weren't any righteous there, you see. Poor Lot, probably the only one, Lot and his family. God got them out. And then he rained down fire and brimstone. Perhaps this will also be the case just before the return of Christ. Godliness may be very rare on the earth. Seems it's going in that direction to me. There won't be too many of the godly in that day. Wickedness will prevail on the earth in that day. And then Christ will return. And before the fire falls on the earth, what's he going to do? What few righteous are left, he's going to take them up in the air to meet with him and be with him forever. And then he will pour fire out on the earth and consume the wicked. It seems that the few hundred years prior to the first coming of the Redeemer, it seems that God's plan was to let his righteous ones in Israel die out so that they would not suffer the severe judgment in the end. Now, I note from this that dying is not a terribly grievous thing for God's people. Now, death has a real sting to it. If you're not a Christian, if you're not God's redeemed, it's terrifying. But for God's people, it's not a grievous thing. It's described here in our text as rest. Do you see that? They shall rest in their beds. They shall rest in their beds. For a righteous man, dying is like going to what? Sleep. It's like going to sleep. He just goes to sleep and he leaves all the suffering behind. And he wakes up in what kind of condition? Peace. He shall enter into peace. All right. I want to quickly cover the next verses 3 forward. Now God is going to speak to the remaining ungodly people in Israel. What did he let happen to the redeemed? Taken away. They went to sleep. Not replenished. So now God is going to talk to this group of people. What's left? In verses 3 through 9. The righteous have been dying out in Israel, and now it is mostly the ungodly who are left. And God is going to have a little talk with them. Now, if you're the ungodly, this is a day you dread. But here's what he says to them, starting in verse 3. Draw near here, ye sons of the sorceress. What does he call them? They're children of a sorceress. That's who their mother was. And seed of the adulterer. And the what? That's who your mother is. A sorceress, an adulteress, and a whore. In other words, you are illegitimate. You get the idea? You're illegitimate. You put great stock in your lineage. You boast that you're a child of Abraham. Well, here is your lineage. You are sons of whores. You are not a part of my synagogue. You are the synagogue of Satan. So we see, first of all, their lineage. They're descendants of evil people, you see. In verse 4, what are they in verse 4? Why, they are mockers. Isn't this what evil men always do to the righteous? They mock. And it says in verse 4, against whom do ye sport yourselves? You see, they make sport. Against whom make ye a wide mouth and draw out the tongue? So they're pictured as their mouth is wide open and their tongue's just a wagging, you see, making sport. So they're apparently making sport of the prophets and of the godly in Israel. In verse 5, they are worshiping idols in verse 5. Let's read it. Inflaming yourselves with idols. Now, what does that mean? Inflaming yourselves with idols. Does this mean that they were setting themselves on fire, using the idols as kindling? If you took it literally, I suppose. This means lusting after their idols. Their heart was on fire for their idols. They passionately went after other gods. Now, commonly, they would set up their idols many times under big shady trees. That's what you would do too in the middle of the summer, you see. Now, this is a nice, convenient, comfortable place to set up our idols. Let's put it under a shade tree. And so it says in verse 5, you're inflaming yourselves with idols under every green tree. Sometimes they built in the forest or under shady trees because of their superstitions. They had certain superstitions that told them that's where they put up their idols. In addition to worshiping idols in verse 5, here's what the lost nation was doing. They sacrificed their children. What depravity was going on in this nation? Look at verse 5. Slaying the children in the valleys under the cliffs of the rocks. This is apparently referring to the practice which Israel adopted of sacrificing their little children to the god Moloch, that we found in the book of Leviticus when Brother Mark taught us years ago. And Israel adopted that ridiculous and cruel practice. That's verse 5. They even made idols, in verse 6, out of the smooth stones. Have you ever walked along a riverbed, a stream bed, and the rocks have kind of been washed over the years and so forth, and they're smooth stones. And the Jews would collect these stones and they would make idols out of these smooth stones. And once they got their idol built, what would they offer to those idols? In verse 6. A drink offering and a meat offering. Now, those were two good things that were commanded in Israel under the law. But who are they offering them to? Idols. How infuriated God must have been. God gave them religious services to perform to Him, to His honor, and they're doing it to their idols. Should God be pleased with this? And the answer is certainly no. They also made idols in verse 7 in the high places. Do you see that? Not only in the under trees, not only down in the riverbed, in the valley, but also in the high places. Oftentimes they went up to the mountains to offer their sacrifices to their idols, not unto God, but to idols. They even put their idols on their doorposts in verse 8. Do you see that? Behind the doors also and the posts hast thou set up thy remembrance. So what they did is they tacked their idols up on their doorposts. The heathen did this so that the idols would protect their homes, you see. The idols didn't believe in the true God. They thought, the people didn't believe in the true God. They believed in their idols, and so they tacked their idols up on their doorposts. Also, it was a place where they could see the idol every day when they came and went out of their homes. So they would be remembered. They would remember each day to give honor to this idol. And so the Jews did the same thing. They hung their idols up on their doorposts, and they remembered every day to worship idols instead of God. Now, what would you have thought that the Jews might have put up on their doorposts? Why, they might have put up the law, the Ten Commandments, something to remind them of their God, but no, they put up other gods on their doorposts. Here's how God viewed this act. God viewed this as an act of adultery. He says, what verse is this? Thou hast discovered thyself to another than me. What verse is that? 8. Thou hast discovered thyself to another. Now that word discovered really means uncovered. You have uncovered yourself to another God. You have gone to bed with your idols. You have agreed to serve other gods. Not only this, in verse 9, they looked to other kings for protection. So they looked to their idols for protection. And who else did they look to in verse 9? Kings. So they sent out a treaty to Assyria or to Babylon or to Egypt. And they said, we're not trusting our God anymore. Let me make a pact with you. So that's what they did in verse 9. It says, and thou wentest to the king with ointment. In other words, you took gifts to the king and didst increase thy perfumes and didst send thy messengers far off and didst debase thyself even unto hell. Last thing, and then we're finished. The result of their idol worship is found in verses 10 through 14. What happened to them in verse 10? They grew what? Wearied. This is what happens when you engage in sin over and over and over and over. You finally grow so wearied of your life. And they grew wearied. All of this great sin, chasing after idols, made them very tired and discouraged. Yet they never fully despaired of their idol worship. It says, yet saidst thou not, there is no hope. You know, if we are ever going to return to God, you first have to come to the point where you realize there's no hope but Jesus Christ, right? If you never come to that point, you may be tired, you may be wearied, but you still say in your heart that there's still hope for me. And this is what they did here. They said they still said there is hope. They put it in the negative, yet saidst thou not, there is no hope. They found the life or the work of their hands profitable to them. Their works is what, their religious services is what they put their hope in. And therefore they were not what, in verse 10? Not grieved. Can you imagine? They have fallen into the grossest adultery against their God, carrying on such acts as are despicable and despisable, and they were not grieved. They didn't come to the end of themselves and repent. God's final message to them now is found in the last two or three verses. God is now like the husband who has discovered his wife in an adulterous relationship with another man. That's how God felt. He was a husband. His wife is having an affair with another man. That's how he felt about the people of Israel. And he says, what has driven you to adultery and prostitution? What has led you down this road? Were you afraid of Assyria or Babylon? What led you to such a sinful course? Why did you forsake me for another? Haven't I been kind to you in the past? Haven't I forgiven you of many sins? And he says in verse 12, I will declare thy righteousness. What does that mean? Now, righteousness here is not used in the sense of moral goodness. What he's saying is, I will show or declare how righteous you really are. In other words, I'll show your lack of righteousness. So verse 12, he says, I will declare thy righteousness and thy what? Works, for they shall not profit thee. Is it going to profit them at all that they built idols? No. Is it going to profit them that they went to the king of Assyria and offered a treaty? No. Or Egypt or Babylon? No, no. Only God would profit them. Only God could profit them. However, God will deliver his people in verse 13. Now we're going to switch back. What about these people? We've been talking about the ruthless wickedness of these people, yet God is going to do what for these people? You see, the redeemed, the remnant. Let's read it. When thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee. But this is still talking about the lost. Here, but the wind shall carry them all away, vanity shall take them, but he that putteth his trust in me, now we're talking about the remnant, he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land and shall inherit my holy mountain. That's sort of the type. The real possessing the land and the real holy mountain is a spiritual thing. And shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of my people. What he's saying in verse 14 is that God is going to clear the way for these people. They're going to inherit spiritual blessings. And so God has a plan for the wicked and the righteous.